Go to.
Hear now the words. Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
Since 1958, we have been making far-reaching exploratory probes into space with projects like Vanguard, Explorer, Discoverer, and Echo. Russia's efforts have been far fewer. But in 1959, employing brilliant navigational techniques, they hit the moon with Lunik 2, 13 hours after launch. Then a month later, they circle the moon with Lunik 3, which radios back photos of the moon's dark side, never before seen. Our own Pioneer 5 goes on a journey of months toward the planet Venus and sends back messages from 22 million miles out in space, a record for radio communication.
For the first time in this campaign, two political leaders...
November 1960. John F. Kennedy is elected 35th President of the United States. And he appoints the future Vice President Johnson to watch over our space program. January 31st, 1961. After 219 hours of training over a 15-month period, this chimpanzee named Ham is sent on a ride down the Atlantic Space Range, the first living creature to travel in a Mercury capsule. Enduring a force of almost 15 Gs, Ham proves a living creature can ride Mercury and be recovered with no ill effects. April 12, 1961. 10 weeks after we have proudly sent a chimp on a suborbital ride, the Kremlin announces it has put the first man into orbit, Major Yuri Gagarin, who has circled the Earth once in 108 minutes aboard a Vostok. Gagarin, the Russian press reports, enjoyed his flight immensely and was ecstatic over how beautiful the Earth looked from orbit. He gets an immense reception in Moscow, Chairman Khrushchev presiding. The news reaches America in the middle of the night. Heedless of the hour, a reporter phones Hampton, Virginia, and routs a top NASA public affairs official from bed to ask for a comment. Groggily, the official replies, "We're all asleep down here." The unfortunate words are taken up by the American press as a comment on our whole space program. Next day, at a White House press conference,
they secured these large boosters, which have led to their being first in Sputnik and led to their first putting their man in space. We are, I hope, going to be able to carry out our efforts with due regard to the problem of the life of the man involved this year, but we are behind, and I'm sure they're making a concentrated effort to stay ahead, so that, as I said in my State of the Union, the news will be worse before it's better, and it will be some time before we catch up.
April 17th, 1961, 5 days after Gagarin's flight, another blow to our national pride. Anti-Castro forces, backed by the CIA, try to invade Cuba. And the result is the Bay of Pigs fiasco. The national mood sinks low. But, as a matter of fact, our space program is far from asleep. Months back in January, some days after Space Chimp Ham proved out the safety of Mercury, the head of Project Mercury, Dr. Robert Gilruth, made a sudden and fateful visit to Langley Field, Virginia, where the astronauts were quartered. As Alan Shepard recalls that day...
Actually, it was no surprise to us one day when Bob Gilruth walked into our office, which all seven of us shared, closed the door and told us that he had made his decision as to who would fly the first two flights.
The entire group was pledged to secrecy. Not until a month later, at a press conference on February 22nd, 1961, is there a public announcement.
I have just made one of the most difficult decisions of my life. From among seven of the most dedicated, intelligent, and strongly motivated men I have ever met, who are almost identical in talent and experience, I have chosen the team of pilots who will make the first two manned flights for Project Mercury.
And even now, Gilruth withholds the name of who will be the first man in case of some unforeseen change. After one more unmanned test, May 2nd is picked as the date for our first manned launch. At Cape Canaveral, an unidentified man in a silver spacesuit waits to board the van that will take him to the launch site. Who is he? Bad weather, after a long wait, scrubs the flight and betrays the identity of astronaut number one. As the scrub is announced and a dejected pilot turns from the door, he proves to be Lieutenant Commander Alan Shepard. Why Shepard from among seven, all rigidly tested and equally trained? What was the factor that made him choice number one? Some instinct on Gilruth's part? A mere hunch? Or some microscopic element in his makeup that only Gilruth could see, and not even he could put into words? All he will ever say is...
that whenever a time comes to make a flight crew selection, we pick the very best man available, and at that time, the one that's most ready at that time, in our opinion.
May 5th. After 3 days of waiting for the weather to clear and Redstone to be refueled, there's a knock on the door at 1:10 a.m. of one of the rooms on the second floor of Hangar S, set aside for the astronauts. It's Dr. Bill Douglas coming to wake Al Shepard.
He appeared certainly to be like anybody else that had been asleep, and I shook him by the shoulder. He blinked his eyes and made some comment, how's it look, or something of that nature. And I assumed that he had been asleep most of the evening. I'm sure he probably didn't really sleep as well as he did one year ago that day. I just don't think he possibly could have. But after getting cleaned up, shaved, bathed, ate breakfast, we conducted a rather quick physical examination. I think more because it's tradition than because it was necessary. I knew Al was perfectly well and healthy. If I just patted him on the back and said, go get dressed, after the flight it was all over, somebody would have said, you mean you didn't even take his blood pressure? So I took his blood pressure, just so that I would be able to say, yes, I took his blood pressure and it was normal. Of course, his blood pressure had been normal since the day he got in the program. There wasn't any reason to suspect that it would change.
Yeah, second platform.
A host of other men have not slept at all this night. Men in the uniforms of Army, Navy, Air Force. Men in casual Florida civvies. Men in coveralls stamped with the company names of contractors whose complex and delicate products are now for the first time to take a human being up for a ride on a rocket. McDonnell, Chrysler, Bendix, Pan American. For almost 5 hours by now, these men have been at work in stark concrete blockhouses near the launch pad in the sea sands of Cape Canaveral. Stationed before banks of dials and signal lights that flash green for okay and red for malfunction, the crews check out hundreds of details in the mechanism and functioning of the white 80-foot firecracker into which have gone the dreams of half a century. Shepard, invited to name his flight, has dubbed it Freedom 7. Freedom, an answer to the politics of our space rival. 7, for the number of astronauts, and for the official number of the spacecraft.
Okay, yeah.
Over scores of radio circuits called loops, the technicians speak to each other and their controllers, each reporting on the workings of some part of the entire system. The name of this checkup process is countdown, and it's already entering most of the languages of man. Like main nerve channels connected to the brain, 10 such loops feed from the flight controllers to the launch control to give periodic readiness reports to the man who alone has the power and responsibility to say go or no go, Flight Director Chris Kraft.
You've tried to think out all of these damn things, and you say, well, I think I know all the things that can happen to this hardware, but some little simple thing that is, you just can't think of what could be causing it.
On his 10 loops comes word about the status of the tracking stations, condition of the booster, location of recovery forces, readiness of the Goddard Computer Center in Maryland, and critically important, weather conditions. There's a high wind right now that could cause a hold.
Astronaut on the way. Pad mechanical.
Go ahead.
I'd like to verify that the pad is in a condition to receive the transfer van.
Roger.
Okay, it is on the way.
Medical sensors are attached to Shepard's body. Then he's helped into his bulky spacesuit. At 3:55 a.m., he leaves his quarters and enters a van for a ride to the launch pad. Arriving at the pad at 4:35 a.m., he's briefed on the mission status by Gordon Cooper. As he waits, Gus Grissom is assigned to keep him company. Then, finally, 5:15 a.m., in the dark before dawn, he enters the gantry elevator to be lifted to his tight lodgings in the capsule atop the firecracker under the eyes of the tense workers.
And he never turned his eyes, you know. That's, I was looking at his face in the camera. He went straight ahead. He never looked at any of us at all. Went straight ahead in. Never turned his eyes.
All this, and all that is to come, takes place in full view of the television cameras and the world press, in contrast to the secrecy of every Russian room. For if there ever was any question about an open book policy, it was decided once and for all the day before in an intriguing phone call to Mercury headquarters from the White House. Remember that we were still smarting from the Bay of Pigs disaster and a public launch of the Vanguard that fizzled out on the ground. In view of all that, and considering the possibility that this launch too might fail, but let Paul Haney tell that story. Paul was public affairs officer for NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. In other words, a visiting fireman at the scene. The phone rang. Bravely, he took the call.
It was the White House. Mrs. Lincoln was on the phone, the president's secretary, and she simply asked for the man in charge, and I looked around and didn't see anyone that outranked me. So I said that I was in charge and identified myself, and she said, just a moment, the president would like to talk to you. And there was a long pause, and Mrs. Lincoln came back on the wire several times, and she said, I'm sorry, he's just taken a call from the Secretary of State, or he's about to start a conversation with so-and-so, but he wants you to hold on. And I was much impressed with the company. And then after perhaps 5 minutes, she came back on and she said the president asked Mr. Salinger to take care of the call. And Pierre got on, whom I'd known for some months. And he said that the president was concerned, was the word he used, about the escape mechanism on the Mercury spacecraft, and sort of inferentially got across the point that there was some concern about live coverage during the liftoff.
Haney reassures Salinger there'll be no trouble with the escape tower, and there's no reason to avoid the live coverage. The countdown proceeds smoothly. Except for one moment, when a technician fails to consider that the ears of history are listening.
I can't hear you on this goddamn. I can hear you on this phone.
Hey, what's your language? We're being recorded every place. T-minus 140 minutes. 140.
Hundreds of miles to the southeast, a U.S. Navy recovery fleet has been deployed down the Atlantic Missile Range and is waiting to catch a man out of the sky. In position are one aircraft carrier, eight destroyers, one radar tracking ship, and several Marine helicopter units. Eight stories above Cape Canaveral, a man in a silver suit waits 4 hours in the close-fitted confines of a capsule. He went to sleep last night as an obscure 37-year-old trainee in a lagging space program. Now, he's about to enter history. As a hero, if he makes it. The sad footnote, if he does not. He is himself a member of the launch team. He has plenty to discuss and plenty to do, but also a certain amount of time to reflect on what is ahead. As it will be put later in a classic gag, of unknown origin that will circulate the world. Do you realize that guy is sitting on top of 10,000 parts, each made by the lowest bidder? Also, there's a whole body of wry humor that has become a password among the original seven during the last year of training. It centers on an invented character, Jose Jimenez, the reluctant astronaut.
My name, Jose Jimenez. I am the chief astronaut with the United States in the planet. My name, Jose Jimenez.
Jose Jimenez was created on television and in a record album by a noted comedy writer and performer, Bill Dana.
Very uncomfortable.
Here is Jose being interviewed by a reporter.
I've been noticing this, Mr. Jimenez. What is this called? A crash helmet?
Oh, I hope not.
Mr. Jimenez, of course, is a very long trip into outer space.
Yes, it's a long trip, Bob.
And I just wonder what you'll do to entertain yourself during those long, lonely, solitary hours when you're all by yourself.
Well, I plan to cry a lot.
It was Al Shepard among the original seven who discovered the recording. At once, Jose was adopted as the unofficial eighth astronaut, to relieve tension and provide a laugh wherever needed. Listen closely. In one flight and another, especially at the critical moment of liftoff, you will hear reference to the imaginary and beloved Jose Jimenez.
Oh, no, they're using the cover now for their schematic.
It's daylight now over Cape Canaveral, but the sun is in a losing fight, and at 7:14 a.m., there's a hold because of the cloud cover.
Yes.
For your information, it appears that the wind velocity is subsiding.
Yeah? You know what? We'll get a reading. Well, I don't have the official reading yet, but we'll be prepared to go either way.
Okay. It's looking better out here.
Well, something's got to look better, let's face it.
Sitting near Chris Kraft is Colonel John Shorty Powers of the United States Air Force, who will become known to all the world as the voice of Mercury. Throughout this flight, and more to come, he will steadily feed information to all the networks and news services on the flight situation.
This is the Mercury Control Center. We have been holding because of the cloud cover. During the hold, we encountered some difficulty with an inverter in the launch vehicle. It has now been determined necessary to replace that inverter. As you have observed, the cherry picker has been brought down. The gantry tower is to be run back up to the launch vehicle so that the workmen can go in and replace this inverter. As Mercury Control standing by, we estimate about 1 hour.
Roger, perform light work task.
Roger, light work.
How does Shepard make the long wait go by?
It really, a hold becomes a period of check and recheck, just to be sure that nothing has been overlooked.
Okay. Roger, perform.
So for the most part, the holds which we have had have not been moments of complete idleness. I think during these holds that one is always anxious for the countdown to continue, because he must remember that all of us who have gone through the process of making space flights have trained for a minimum of 2 years, in some cases more, for this particular moment. And there is a definite anxiety, desire to press ahead, to get on with the job for which one is trained for such a long period.
Okay, okay. Ready to resume the count?
Roger, ready to resume the count.
Al Shepard is not alone. At their various posts, his six fellow astronauts share the strain and tension. Gordon Cooper in the blockhouse near the launching pad, checking the weather downrange. Deke Slayton at the console inside Mercury Control, where he is to do most of the talking to Shepard during flight. John Glenn checking out the capsule and standing by as backup pilot. Gus Grissom, now a passive spectator. Wally Schirra and Scott Carpenter circling the area and two jet fighters ready to chase and photograph the rocket after liftoff. Finally, 10 seconds before 9:34 a.m., Deke Slayton starts the final countdown. His voice smooth, even, mechanical.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Through the rush and roar come the reassuring words of Al Shepard talking from the capsule.
Roger, liftoff, and the clock has started.
And from Deke Slayton. Okay, Jose. And more significant, those words from the cabin. The clock has started. The clock in the capsule that starts at liftoff. The clock in Freedom 7 that is now ticking off history. The phrase will become standard for all future liftoffs. And the clock has started. Already, the two jet fighters, piloted by friends Girard and Carpenter, have darted away to approach the rocket and photograph. Wally at ground level, Scott at 31,000 feet.
This is Freedom 7. The fuel is go, 1.2G. Cabin at 14 PSI. Oxygen is go. Cabin pressure is holding at 5.5. Cabin holding at 5.5. Okay, it's a lot smoother now, a lot smoother.
For all of Shepard's New Hampshire cool, his voice betrays his excitement as the curve of his flight carries him at more than 5,100 miles an hour to a high of 116.5 miles above the Earth, eastward along the Atlantic Missile Range.
He's going to hand control movements now. Switching to manual control of the pitch attitude.
Pitch is okay.
Pitch control A-OK.
Switching to manual yaw.
Switching to manual yaw. Medical monitor reports everything A-OK in the cockpit.
Roger, 3 OK.
Yaw is OK. Switching manual roll.
Shepard proves himself more than a merely passive man in the can, which was the limit of Gagarin's role on his flight.
Roll is OK.
Roll OK. Let's go to it.
On the periscope, what a beautiful view.
Pilot reports all systems in the cockpit A-OK and operating properly.
A-OK, an old telegrapher's term, which Powers now introduces into the manned space program. He will use it 10 times on this flight, and Shepard himself, never.
Pilot reports assuming retro attitude, initiating retro fire sequence.
Retro one. Very smooth. Retro two. Retro three. All three retros are fired. I'm on fly-by-wire, going to re-entry attitude. Okay, Buster, re-entry attitude. Switching ASCS normal. T-build-up. Three.
He reports his situation, including the build-up of G-forces, back to the CAPCOM, short for capsule communicator, Deke Slayton, in Mercury Control, back at Canaveral.
Okay.
CAPCOM, how do you read now?
Roger, Deke, reading you loud and clear, Harvey.
Switched over to GDI.
Hello, card file 2-3, card file 2-3, Freedom 7, over.
Freedom 7.
Now, Al tries to establish communications with a circling airplane of the recovery fleet that waits below him in the sea. Codename, card file. He's reporting that his main parachute is open and is functioning properly, that he's set up the landing bag, which will help cushion the shock of landing, and has jettisoned his remaining fuel.
The Mercury recovery forces downrange report a visual sighting of the spacecraft descending in the parachute or hanging from the parachute.
15 minutes after liftoff, gentled by the huge orange and white parachute, Freedom 7 splashes down into the Atlantic. 302 miles from Canaveral, only 4 miles off target. At once, the lead Marine helicopter drops a hook onto the top of the capsule and lifts it a few feet out of the water so the Shepherd can open the hatch and crawl out. Then a second cape, with a horse collar at the end, is dropped to Shepherd and hauls him to safety aboard the helicopter. Laden thus with its two space fish, the helicopter then heads for the aircraft carrier Lake Champlain and proudly deposits both on deck to the wild cheers of the carrier crew. Later, as he starts the serious and secretive business of debriefing, Shepherd's first words are,
"My name,
Jose Jimenez.
Jose Jimenez. Chief Astronaut.
U.S.
U.S. Interplanetary Force.
Well, you appear about as well as when I saw you at the Cape.
Meanwhile, his body, wired to radio transmitters, has sent back enough medical data to fill 40 pages of a report. Washington gives Shepherd a hero's welcome. True that his 15-minute suborbital ride was a small project compared with Gagarin's flight. But Shepherd has proved beautifully what he was designated to prove, that we could rocket a man off the Earth and bring him back safe and well, that the entire Mercury flight system was workable and effective. In short, the two fundamental goals outlined 3 years before by the think team of the Space Task Group have been achieved. We've succeeded in man-rating the machine and machine-rating the man.
And therefore, I'm going to again express my congratulations to Alan Shepard.
As the crowning reward,
very proud of him.
Al stands in the Rose Garden of the White House to receive the Distinguished Service Medal that the President, in his boyish eagerness, drops to the lawn while moving to pin it on Shepherd.
Space Committee, who are with us today, and this decoration, which has gone from the ground up here.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. And Mr. Webb. I thought that last Friday was a thrilling day. Today even surpasses last Friday. And as a matter of fact, I got far less sleep last night than I did the night before the flight.
Next, on May 25th, 1961, President Kennedy appears before a special session of Congress.
We go into space because whatever mankind must undertake, free men must fully share. I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities, to provide the funds which are needed to meet the following national goals. First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
Thus, only 20 days after Shepard's flight, we raise our sights in the space program, and Congress gives its hearty approval. For some time, we've had the Apollo program in the works. It was intended only to circle the moon. Now the objective of Apollo is vastly expanded to achieve President Kennedy's goal. The dream of the ages has become an official government project, echoing Tsiolkovsky's historic declaration, "The Earth is the cradle of the mind, but one cannot live forever in a cradle." To set foot on the soil of the asteroids, to lift by hand a rock from the moon.
I hope you have enjoyed what you have heard, and I look forward to your comments.
Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. No promises, but there's a good chance I'll read out whatever you send me. If you like these shows enough to support them, and you're not comfortable mailing envelopes full of cash, you can set up a recurring monthly tip for the storyteller at patreon.com/publius_reads.